And are either of you, we're about 2 minutes early, are either of you expecting anyone else to join us, clients or
other
interested parties?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, then I think we will proceed. Mr. Marshall, will you please call the case?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Jessen, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case 821-0572, Eric John Henderson Bay versus State of Minnesota.
Thank you and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The rules are the same as if we were in the actual courtroom. You each will have 15 minutes to present your argument, and Mr. Langsdorf, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. The hearing is being recorded and will be posted on the court's website. At the beginning of your argument, would you please state your name for the record? And with that, Mr. Langsdorf, are you ready to proceed?
I am. Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant Eric Henderson Bay. To be assigned points for an out-of-state conviction, the out-of-state conviction must both be defined as a felony in Minnesota, and the defendant must have received a sentence that would be a felony-level sentence in Minnesota. Mr. Henderson Bay was convicted of having an unregistered gun in Illinois under a statute that says no person may acquire or possess any firearm, stun gun, or taser within this state without having in his or her possession a firearm owner's identification card previously issued in his or her name by the Department of State Police under the provisions of this act. And that's what Mr. Henderson Bay received the point for on the 889 unlawful use of weapon case. Now, that conviction fails the test because there's no equivalent law requiring possession of a Minnesota owner's identification card in Minnesota. And I think in our view, this is probably just a legal question of whether there's a similar law that Mr. Henderson Bay could be charged with in Minnesota. If there's not, and I'm not aware of any that is, then there's no basis for assigning a point for that conviction, and there isn't really even a need to know anything else about that conviction. It doesn't really matter when the sentence, how long he was sentenced for, when he came off supervision or anything like that, because what he was convicted of wasn't even actually a crime in the state of Minnesota.
So that Mr. Longsdorf, if yes. I may, I just want to understand your position on this. Is it that it's, you believe this is a legal decision for us to make, or should we be remanding the issue back to give the state an opportunity to establish whether this was an equivalent felony?
I think that it's just a legal question for the court to decide, to look at the statute and say, well, there's no equivalent statute in Minnesota, so not having a firearm owner's card wouldn't be a crime here, so there shouldn't be a point applied. And because of that, I think that the conviction fails and that it was improper to assign a point for that particular conviction. Now, Minnesota Statute 609.035 states that if a person's conduct constitutes more than one offense under the laws of this state, the person may be punished only for one offense. And the sentencing guidelines and the comments state that in cases of multiple offenses that arise from a single course of conduct, points are only allowed for the highest severity level. In this case, the jury was literally instructed that the criminal sexual conduct allegations were the conduct for the pattern of harassing conduct. And I think we can see that in the jury instructions, because for the first degree criminal sexual conduct charge, the jury was told, fifth, the defendant's acts took place on or around March 15th of 2008, through May 31st, 2009, in Ramsey or Dakota County, Minnesota. Then in instructing on the pattern of harassing conduct, the court started out saying, as I indicated in the instructions, the state must prove a pattern of harassing conduct by proving two or more criminal acts within a five-year period. The state seeks to meet this element by proving the following criminal acts: criminal sexual conduct in the first degree against O.W. from March 15th of 2008 through May 31st, 2009. Then the court went on to instruct on four separate second-degree criminal sexual conduct counts related to OW that all fit within that March 15th, 2008 through May 31st, 2009 timeframe. And then the jury was instructed on three criminal sexual conduct counts related to CW. So five of the eight allegations of the harassing conduct were just relisting the criminal sexual conduct allegations against OW. And one of them related to CW, I think, must have been an error because I don't think there was any factual basis for giving an instruction related to CW in 2009. But the way the jury is instructed and with the general verdict form that was used, there's no way to know which of the criminal sexual conduct allegations the jury relied upon to find Mr. Henderson Bate guilty.
So, Mr. Now, Longstorff, doesn't that present as a problem, though, because isn't it your client's burden at this stage to, you know, it comes down to the burden of proof, right? Your client's burden to show that the district court improperly assigned him this criminal history or point based upon kind of your argument. And I'm sorry if I'm not putting this very clearly, but and as you said, we don't know. Did the jury come and say it's because of two of the eight are the ones against the younger daughter versus the older daughter? We don't know. And that's your client's burden of proof. So how can we do anything but affirm here on this issue?
I agree that my client has the burden of proof on this, but again, I think this is sort of a legal specific argument, not necessarily a factual argument, which is that while the prosecution, as it argued, it says we don't need unanimity or specificity to find a defendant guilty, as in that Rucker case, but the question of whether a defendant can be sentenced on two convictions for the same factual allegations is a separate question from whether the jury could find him guilty of both. And I think under these circumstances that that's governed by the sentencing guidelines in 609.035, which say that if that defendant has multiple convictions for the same course of conduct, he can be sentenced on the highest offense. And I think the proof was in the way the jury was instructed, where they were literally, I mean, it is quite literal that the criminal sexual conduct is the harassing conduct. And so under those circumstances, I think that the record shows that Mr. Henderson Bay has had his criminal sexual conduct conviction, actually his sentence on that increased by the criminal sexual conduct, which was in the form of the pattern harassing conduct.
But isn't that an issue? This is what I'm struggling with here, help me with this, that should have been addressed if it was, and the state argues in some ways it was, on a, you know, direct appeal as opposed to what we had before us, which is a motion to correct the sentence.
And as a follow-up, you haven't shown, as I read your arguments, that the jury did convict your client solely on the offenses against OW. It could have been part of the three acts against CW that were part of count six.
And I agree that so there's kind of the first part is, I don't think that this has to be raised in a direct appeal because there's a distinction between challenging a conviction, which Mr. Henderson Bay did on his direct appeal, and then using a conviction to assign a criminal history point. And I do think that that's why this wouldn't be proper to treat this as a petition for post-conviction relief either, because this really is limited to counting points and things that Rule 27.03 would apply to. So I don't think that there's any procedural bar or time bar that would preclude getting relief in this case. And on to the second part of that, on direct appeal, this court concluded that it was an error to try the CW allegations along with the OW allegations. And the way that went, it was the prosecution was the party that made the decision to proceed that way. And I think that it should have to live with the fact that now as it relates to sentencing, because of the way it proceeded, it's created a scenario where there isn't any way to distinguish what criminal sexual conduct charges the jury relied on to convict on the pattern of harassing conduct. And we're in a situation where because Mr. Henderson Bay was found guilty of the first degree criminal sexual conduct, we can feel fairly certain the jury also convicted him on that part of the pattern of harassing conduct. and therefore his criminal sexual conduct sentence has been increased based on the criminal sexual conduct allegations that form the basis for the criminal sexual conduct conviction in the first place. And this could have been prevented if the CW charges weren't tried at the same time in the first place. Then we would know for sure if that conviction could be used to assign a point, or the pattern of harassing conduct could have been broken out in a specific way, like the criminal sexual conduct allegations. And then it would also be clear if the conviction could be used to assign a point or not. But that's not what happened. And now we have ambiguity and uncertainty. And I think that the Brown case that we cited in Mr. Henderson Bay's brief says that if there's ambiguity in sentencing, it should be construed in favor of the defendant. And here, since there's no way that we can know that Mr. Henderson Bay's criminal sexual conduct conviction wasn't increased on the basis of the very same criminal sexual conduct allegations that convicted him, he shouldn't have been given a point for that pattern of harassing conduct when he was sentenced on the criminal sexual conduct. And another way that I was thinking about it is that if, when it comes to what a defendant can be found guilty of and then what he can be sentenced on, they're really two different things. And it's not all that important for finding a defendant guilty that there be this unanimity and specificity, but I think it is important for the purposes of sentencing because there is that specific prohibition against using a conviction based on the same behavioral incident to assess a point for sentencing on a conviction, another conviction based on the same act. And because that's what we have here, I think it was inappropriate to add that point. And then the district court also denied Mr. Henderson Bay's motion related to what was listed on the sentencing worksheet as the 7-17-1991 possession with intent to deliver conviction.
And I am trying to understand the different dates that you have said that it was concluded. Your initial brief at page 11, you say that it was on October 24th, 1991. Later in your reply brief, you say it's December 12th, 1991. When I looked at the exhibit, and I'm looking at page 3 of the exhibit, it says 8/24/94 probation terminated unsatisfactory. So I'm just trying to figure out where you came up with those other two dates.
The date, the specific date is the 12/12/1991. In this, we got what we could to try to show this out of Chicago, which was that certified disposition. And I think part of the problem is that Mr. Henderson Bay wasn't ever given an opportunity to testify about this. But what actually did happen there was when he was sentenced on that 10/24/1991 illegal possession and sale of the firearm, that was an executed prison sentence. And the earlier conviction was actually closed at that time, such that we believe that the appropriate date off from supervision would be the 12/12/1991 date. And if we use the 15-year decay period, we get to 12/12/2006, which is prior to any of
that. What do you do with page 3 where it says 8/24/94 probation terminated unsatisfactory? What do you think that means?
Well, I think that it means that that's when Mr. Henderson Bay had the paperwork or something was filed to do it. But I think Mr. Henderson Bay would testify or would have that what really happened was that, and he doesn't believe that he was on supervision at all on that case because of the amount of executed time that he received on the prior conviction. And just to close that out, then the criminal sexual conduct date started on 3/15/2008, so there wouldn't have been any criminal history point for that if that is the date. And absent questions, I don't have anything further.
Judge Justin or Judge Kirk, do you have any more questions? Thank you very much. You can hear from respondent now.
May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, and I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. As Judge Jessen has already pointed out, in this post-appeal motion to correct sentence under Rule 27.03, the appellant bears the burden to establish that his sentence was unauthorized by law and illegal. He has failed to meet his burden in this case. He's failed to prove that there is not an equivalent crime in Minnesota for his unlawful use of a weapon conviction out of Illinois. He has failed to prove that his possession with intent to deliver cocaine had a conviction had decayed. And he has failed to prove that the criminal sexual conduct first degree and the pattern of harassing conduct convictions were part of a single behavioral incident. So for those reasons, because he has failed to meet his burden, the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying his motion, and this court should affirm the district court's denial of the motion. Turning first to the unlawful use of a weapon out of a conviction out of Illinois, appellant is indicating that this is a legal issue, but actually it's a factual issue. And the appellant bears the burden to prove the underlying facts of that conviction to show that there isn't an equivalent crime here in Minnesota. The only thing he points to in the record is his own recitation of the underlying facts that he provided in the PSI.
If I may, Ms. Light, I thought that the state bears, my understanding reading the case law, is the state bears the burden of establishing the facts necessary for the district court to consider the out-of-state conviction. And I think that was why initially, at least, the district court gave the state time to do that. And you're seeming to say, no, that's on appellant to do. And could you explain to me why that state doesn't bear that initial burden?
Sure. And so I would acknowledge that the state does bear the burden to prove criminal history score at the time of sentencing. But procedurally, case law, the State v. Williams case says at this stage, in a post-appeal motion to correct sentence under Rule 27, that now the appellant bears the burden because he did not raise these issues in his direct appeal. He did not raise these issues prior. And so now he's coming 9 years later with a motion to correct sentence. And so at this stage under the Williams case, he bears the burden to show that it was illegal at that time. And this issue is a little confusing and a little complicated. So one of my arguments is that he has failed to meet his burden because he has not established the underlying facts of this case. We cannot rely solely on his own summary of what this conviction was based on. I can't even see in the PSI or other in the record an actual cite to the statute that opposing counsel is quoting from. So we don't even know for sure that is the statute that he was convicted under in Illinois. So for that reason, the district court wouldn't have abused its discretion in denying his motion on that basis. However, that's not what the district court did. The district court actually just granted the state's request for more time to come up with that record to affirmatively prove or disprove whether there is an equivalent crime in Minnesota or not. So, on one basis, my primary argument is this court can just affirm the denial of the motion to correct sentence because appellant has not met his burden. In the alternative, because the record is it's left unresolved. If this court was uncomfortable with affirming because there is kind of this unresolved issue below, the appropriate remedy in that case would be to remand to allow further fact-finding on the facts of the conviction out of Illinois. See if the state can produce records regarding that conviction, when actually I believe that it would be appellant's burden to provide those records to the court if it was remanded on that issue.
Counsel, isn't it true that all we'd really need to know is the statute and compare the two statutes?
I would agree that would be sufficient, but we don't have anything in the record confirming which statute he was convicted of in Illinois.
But at that point, it wouldn't be a factual determination. It'd be a question of law as to the similarity between Minnesota law and Illinois law.
I would agree with that. if we knew what statute he was convicted of. So at this stage, I'm just saying there is a factual issue left open because appellant has not bore his burden of showing that was that the statute that he was convicted under. Moving to the 1991 possession of intent to deliver cocaine conviction and whether it has decayed or not, I would agree with Judge Riley's reading of the Exhibit 1 below, as well as in the PSI. The record just does not support the dates as cited by appellant. And the record clearly shows in the Exhibit 1 that he offered to the district court that he was discharged from probation unsuccessfully on August 24th, 1994. So that is the date that you start counting the 15 years. And so clearly it had not decayed and was correctly used in calculation of his criminal history score. And then lastly, moving to the issue of the single behavioral incident issue, kind of two arguments. First, I believe that this issue is barred, both as untimely and under NAFLA, as it should be construed as a post-conviction motion because he is essentially trying to attack his underlying conviction by arguing that there's ambiguity in the jury verdict. We don't know exactly what facts the jury found. That's attacking essentially that conviction, and that should have been something raised at the trial level or in a direct appeal on the unanimous verdict issue. I think it would be problematic to allow that type of argument to be made now because it might encourage defendants to not raise those issues at the trial level so that they could make this kind of sentencing argument later. And so I don't think that's something that we would want to encourage in this case.
So could you help me with this? Because I'm struggling to see why this would be time barred since the limited what he's trying to do here on this post-conviction, motion to correct the sentence is just to challenge his criminal history score based on that. Why shouldn't he be able to do that? That seems which he can do at any time, right? I mean, do you have any case law that would help us with this one, Ms. Light?
Not that I can cite to here and now, unfortunately, Your Honor. Yes, I agree that, he can move to correct his sentence at any time. And then at this stage, it would be his burden to show that his sentence is illegal. And so then in that case, you could reach the merits, but precisely because he's trying to, challenge his underlying conviction, he's not meeting his burden, even if you were to reach the merits in this case, because he's simply pointing to the ambiguity in the jury verdict. And because we don't know exactly what facts the jury relied on, that shows that that demonstrates that he has not met his burden to prove that his sentence is illegal because it's based on these two convictions that are arising out of the same behavioral incident. So I think there's two ways that this court could come out on this issue. One would be to treat it as a post-conviction motion and find that it's barred, or to reach the merits and but conclude that because we don't know, it leaves open the possibility that the jury did rely on the facts relating to multiple victims. There are two victims here that that the pattern of harassing conduct is based on. The jury could have found that these incidents occurred over several years, from 2003 to 2009. That the jury could have found that these incidents occurred in different locations in multiple counties, and so because if you were to look at the same behavioral incident issue, you're looking at time and place. You're looking at a continuous and uninterrupted course of conduct. and whether it was motivated by a single criminal objective. And so I think because we don't know exactly what the jury based its verdict on, it clearly could have found multiple occasions, multiple victims, several years of this continuous, or, you know, this these incidents occurring in different different times and places and with different victims. And so appellant has failed to prove that this is a single behavioral incident. You know, and I would just note and direct this court to its prior opinion in this case arising from the direct appeal, and that was issued in 2015, where appellant raised a severance issue, and this court found, you know, based on the appellant's arguments, that these were not arising out of the same behavioral incident. And so this court should find the same now, because it's the same case and same facts. So unless there are other questions, I would conclude by saying, you know, in bringing this post-appeal Rule 27 motion, the appellant bears the burden to demonstrate that his sentence is unlawful and unauthorized by law, and he has simply failed to do so in this case. And therefore, we request that this court affirm the district court's denial of his Rule 20 motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Light. Mr. Longsdorf, do you have any rebuttal? Please unmute yourself.
Sorry about that. I'd like to start with the 889 unlawful use of a firearm. I would just point out that really the only facts anywhere that I was able to find in this case about that, including the sentencing worksheets, came out of Mr. Henderson's BACO sexual examination, where he brought a hunting gun to and didn't permit. Since that's literally the only thing that has any amount of proof about that case, and the statute that we cited is the one that he believes that he had been charged under, I think that he does have, or he has met his burden of proof, because there isn't anything that proves anything else about it other than that's what he was charged with, that's why he was charged, and that's the statute that matches that. And I don't think there's any statute that matches that in Minnesota. And then the other thing I just want to touch on is you know, the idea that Mr. Henderson Bay hasn't met his burden of proof, but he hasn't had an opportunity to present evidence. I mean, we did this to start the petition, but he hasn't had an opportunity to give any testimony about these things. And I think that's part of the problem with the summary denial, saying, well, he hasn't met his burden if he hasn't had a chance, because some of this would have to come in through Mr. Henderson Bay explaining what happened and how these things went. And then the court would need to make a credibility determination on that, I think. So I do think there's a problem with denying this, as Mr. Bay not being able to meet his burden, and he wasn't given the opportunity to do that. And then real the post-conviction versus 2703, I do think that there's a definite distinction, and you can see that in cases like Munt and Stewart and Coles that were cited by the prosecution in their brief, where if it is a sneak attack on a conviction, then it's a post-conviction and a court can treat it that way and say that, well, it's procedurally barred or time barred. But if you do just limit it to counting, which is really what Mr. Henderson Bay is doing here, then I think it's appropriate for Rule 27.03. And I don't think that it can be time or procedurally barred under those circumstances. And absent questions, that's all I have.
Judge Jessen or Judge Kirk, any questions? Thank you very much for your well-briefed arguments and your arguments this morning. We will have an order out with, or an opinion out within the 90 days.